to cultivate our motivation so that we know why we're here. So think that we'll listen and discuss together this evening so that we can understand what the Dharma is, what it isn't, and so that we'll know how to practice correctly so that we can let the Dharma seep into our mind, integrate it with our life, and in that way help to uphold the Dharma, to preserve the Dharma. So let's do this not simply for our own well-being, but remembering that we're living together with all sentient beings who are in the same predicament of samsara that we're in. They all want to be happy and be free of suffering just as we do. And so let's do our practice for the benefit of all sentient beings so that we can progress on the path to full awakening. And while we're on the path and after we attain Buddhahood, to really contribute to the well-being of each and every living being, no matter how they treat us or who they are. So let's have that long-term motivation. And what we're doing tonight is one drop in the bucket of going in that direction. So our topic this evening is being a 21st century Buddhist. So this is something that His Holiness the Dalai Lama speaks about a lot. And he often does it in the context of saying that the 20th century was a century with a lot of violence, a lot of war, a lot of misunderstanding. And so let's try harder in this century to make it a century of peace. And being a 21st century Buddhist is incorporated in that. Seems to me like so far we haven't done very well on making this a century of peace. But there's still 85 years, so we can keep trying. So, being a 21st century Buddhist, what does that mean? So, I want to speak about some of the points that His Holiness brings up when he talks about this. Because some people may think, oh, 21st century Buddhist, that means we can redesign Buddhism to make it fit with contemporary culture. Yeah. So the meditation hall can become a disco. You know, no, that's not what we're meaning by 21st century Buddhist. We're not talking about changing the Dharma teachings, because what the Buddha taught was the path to enlightenment. Can any of us come up with something better than what the Buddha taught? Yeah. If you think that you can come up with something better than the path to enlightenment that the Buddha taught, then you are probably enlightened. And if you think you're enlightened, maybe you're not. I always tell people if they meet a so-called teacher that talks about how enlightened they are, hold on to your wallet. Okay. So one of the things that His Holiness, the points His Holiness brings up for being a 21st century Buddhist is we've got to be educated. We have to be educated Buddhists. We can't be blind believers. You know, in the past, in past centuries, literacy was not spread very widely in many countries. And so sometimes for an illiterate population, the Dharma was simplified and so on. But that's not the case now. Now people are literate, people are educated. Yeah, you have access to the Dharma, to teachings, to teachers, to books. And so it's very important to be an educated Buddhist. Yeah, to really study the Dharma, to learn it well, and then to put it into practice. If we don't study and we don't learn, but we want to meditate, then we don't know how to meditate properly. Meditation doesn't mean just sitting down with your legs crossed and your eyes closed. Okay? We have to learn what meditation means. Okay? So the Buddha always spoke of three kinds of wisdom. The wisdom arising from hearing or studying the teachings, from thinking about or contemplating the teachings, and then from meditating on the teachings. So that we have to start with learning. And in our learning, some people like to learn a lot, some people like to learn by reading, some by doing, some by hearing teachings. So we'll all have different ways of learning the teachings. But we need to learn, and we need to learn what the Buddha taught. And that means, really making an effort to come to Dharma teachings, to go to retreats. When you read a book, to try and read it from the beginning to the end without reading one chapter and then saying, "It's too hard, La," and then pulling out a comic book or something. Okay. It can be challenging to study the Dharma. But we've all managed to get through school, and we all know how to read. So if we put some energy into studying the Dharma, we'll definitely learn. Okay? And that learning is very helpful, because that sets us on our two feet going in the right direction. If we don't learn, then we just come in and we make up our own Dharma, whatever sounds good to us. It's kind of like when I went to my first meditation course, I didn't know anything. So the teachers were late, so one of the monks said, "Well, let's sit and meditate." I had no idea what that meant. So I didn't want to look like I didn't know what I was doing, even though I didn't know what I was doing. And so I remembered seeing some magazines with people sitting like this, with their eyes rolled back in their head. So I sat like that. An easy way to get a headache. Thank goodness the teachers came very quickly. But I had no idea. So it was very helpful to learn. To learn, we have to put in some time and energy. If we don't put in some time and energy, then this week we go to one class, next week we go do something else, and then the week after that maybe we sleep. Then we have no way of, getting some systematic kind of Buddhist education. So you need to know how much time you have in your daily life, if you're able to go for weekly teachings or whatever, but to really make it a priority in your life and to also set up a daily practice. So even if your daily practice is short, even if it's 15 minutes, regular daily practice is really invaluable. So to be a 21st century Buddhist, you know, we have to be educated. We can't, you know, just kind of sit there, you know. And when other people may ask us questions about Buddhism, so we should, you know, try to know how to respond. And if we don't know how to respond, then to be frank with the other person, don't make up an answer if you don't know what you're talking about. Just say, I don't know. But I will go ask my teacher, or I will go look it up, and then use that as an opportunity to learn more yourself. Okay? So, learning the Dharma. His Holiness also encourages us to learn, to not be sectarian in our learning of the Dharma. Okay? So, by that, he means to be very open-minded towards all the Buddhist traditions. Yeah. To not just say, I follow this Buddhist religion, you're from another one, you got it all wrong. The Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught in my tradition are better than the Four Noble Truths he taught in your tradition. Give me a break. You know? Because when you look at it, the Buddha didn't teach Theravada, he didn't teach Mahayana, he didn't teach Pali Buddhism or Sanskrit Buddhism or Pure Land Buddhism or Chan Buddhism. The Buddha taught the Dhamma. He taught the Dharma. All these traditions developed historically later on. Yeah. They all come from the same root. Everybody talks in one way or another about the four truths of the Aryas. In one way or another about the three higher trainings, ethical conduct, concentration, wisdom. In one way or another about the Noble Eightfold Path. In one way or another, about the four Brahma Viharas, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. All the traditions talk about serenity and insight, or shamatha and vipassana. So they may have different explanations of these, but all these topics are shared in common. So it's good to learn these topics well, but also as we go on, maybe not so much at the beginning, but as we go on in our learning, you know, we may follow principally one tradition, but to learn something about the other traditions also. So the book, Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, that's out there. I have the incredible privilege of co-authoring that with His Holiness. And, you know, one of the reasons he wanted it is because he really wanted Buddhists to know more about each other and not be so locked into their own tradition. That doesn't mean that we, you know, say, well, everything's the same and kind of make soup. Not like that. But that we're educated Buddhists again. Yeah. And so we know. And I'll just give you an example of that. Because I met the Dharma actually in America, and then I went to Nepal and India to study. So I was living with the Tibetan refugee community for many, many years, and I just learned Tibetan Buddhism. And then my teacher sent me here to Singapore. I was one of the early teachers at ABC. And I came here like, there's lots of different kinds of Buddhism in Singapore. You know? And I realized that I didn't know very much about the different kinds of Buddhism. And in the process, I realized that there's a lot of misunderstandings among the different Buddhist traditions, because they didn't know much about each other in the early days, because Buddhism had spread far and wide. They didn't have the internet, they didn't have the telephone, they didn't have easy transportation. So all the different traditions grew up in different geographical areas, and whatever they knew about other traditions was basically hearsay. And so there were a lot of misconceptions. So that's why, when I came here, I really started learning more about the different Buddhist traditions and realized, boy, there's a lot of misunderstandings. And I think that's one of the things that His Holiness wanted to correct, because it's important for all of us Buddhists to work together. Yeah, instead of quarreling with each other, we need to work together to sustain the Dharma, to spread the Dharma, and to act as one voice in this world when we speak about current issues. For example, climate change. Buddhism has a lot to say about climate change. We have a lot to say about war, or the absence of it. Yeah. Can we talk together as a unified group and present to the world some of the Buddha's teachings about fortitude and tolerance and love and compassion? Yeah. If we know something about each other's traditions and the common things, we can have a common voice. Yeah. If we don't, then we divide into different groups, and then you know how sentient beings are. We're in this group, we believe in this that group. Did you hear what they said? You know? You, but I came to Buddhism to learn the Dharma. I didn't come to Buddhism for politics. Yeah. My country has enough politics. Too much politics. You know, that's not why I came to Buddhism. It was for that. Yeah? So, you know, we need, as a Buddhist community, to function together and to be harmonious. Yeah. And I can't emphasize this enough. You know, every 2 weeks, the Sangha, the monastic community, we do our posada. I think the Pali word is uposatha, something. Anyway, you know what it is, maybe. Okay. But it's when we confess and purify and restore our precepts. In order to do the posada ceremony, the Sangha has to be in harmony. We go through a set of questions before we do the ceremony. You know, is the Sangha together? Is the Sangha in harmony? Harmony is so important in our Buddhist community. Yeah. Harmony between different groups, between different traditions, harmony within every Dharma center. Because the Buddha said that harmony is actually, you know, what sustains the Dharma. And the Dharma isn't going to be destroyed by outsiders. You know, don't worry about the Christians. They have enough to do themselves. Okay? They're not going to destroy the Dharma. What destroys the Dharma is when we don't practice well, when we spend our time in politics and quarreling and disharmony. Yeah. So it's really important, 21st century Buddhism. Okay? We have to respect all the traditions, all the practitioners, work together. Yeah. And to do this, it doesn't mean that we all have to be exactly alike. You know, sometimes people have this idea that to get along, we have to all believe exactly the same things. No. The Buddha gave many different kinds of teachings because people have different kinds of mentalities. Yeah. He wasn't looking for us all to come out as cookie-cutter Buddhists. Okay. People have different mentalities, different interests, different dispositions. We're going to be different, but we're rooted in the same fundamental teachings. We have the same goal of nirvana. Okay. We have the same wish to gain the realizations of shamatha, vipassana, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. We may have different ways of practicing. That's fine. No problem. We may have slightly different teachings on how to meditate on selflessness. That's okay. We don't have to say everything's exactly the same and there's only one way to believe, which coincidentally happens to be my way. Yeah. Have you ever noticed that in the world? Yeah. Oh yes, there's many different ways to do it, but there's one best way. Mine. I think there's some ego problems there. So to have an open mind that in which we see our commonalities, but we also see our differences, and we respect our differences. Because we are different sentient beings, aren't we? Aren't we? So that's fine. Then broadening out from the Buddhist community, part of being a 21st century Buddhist involves knowing about other religions and having some interfaith dialogue so that as religious people, we know about each other and we respect each other. Okay. So, I know at the Abbey we have interreligious dialogue whenever possible. We've become friends with a few different groups of Catholic nuns. Yeah. And we talk about all the patriarchy in our own religion. But in our town in Spokane, there's the city council wants to set up a interfaith council. So the Abbey wants to participate in that. Okay? So interfaith dialogue is important. And I know the situation here is there's a particular kind of situation in Singapore. Dialogue means that we respect each other. We're not trying to convert each other. Okay? So somebody trying to convert us, or us trying to convert somebody else, that's not dialogue. Okay, that's conversion. That's disrespecting people. Okay, real dialogue we share with an awareness of our differences and with respect for the differences. So we've had some Christians come to the Abbey. They want to learn about Buddhism. Some came just a couple months ago. You took them around, or was it Venerable Chuni? Somebody took them around. And, you know, took them on a tour, explained what our meditation hall is, the different things in the meditation hall, and showed them scriptures and talked about, you know, what we do. And that's fine. It was completely educational. of dialogue's good. Whenever somebody tries to convert somebody else, I stop it immediately, because that's not dialogue. That's not respecting each other. Okay. I want to remember what other things I wrote down for 21st century Buddhists. Okay. I touched on this briefly in the first point, but in our study, in our learning, to use reasoning, yeah, to not just be blind, have blind belief. Okay, so it's not just reading something, and the Buddha said this, so I believe. It's reading it, studying it, asking questions, thinking about how does that make sense. How does it relate to my life? Does it describe my life? How can I incorporate that in my life so that I can create more peace and more wisdom in my own mind? Okay. So it's not just, well, the Buddha said this, so I believe. It's really understanding things. Okay. Now, granted, some people are more faith oriented, some people are more devotionally oriented, that's fine. Yeah. But you can have understanding that supports your faith and your devotion. Okay. And when you really get into the teachings, then, for example, to understand what the triple gem is, what the three jewels are, Nagarjuna, 2nd century Indian sage, gave this beautiful explanation based on dependent arising and emptiness that he used to prove the existence of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's an incredible teaching that he gave. It's in Buddhism, one teacher, many traditions. But, you know, as we progress, to learn this kind of thing so that we can really understand what are the three jewels. Yeah. We say we go to refuge for them. What does going to refuge mean? How do we use the three jewels to help us in our life? What are the three jewels? So especially to learn this kind of thing. You know, I think it was last year when I came here, I started asking some questions. You know how you do Namo Tassa at the beginning? So I was asking people, okay, what do each of these words mean? Yeah. Some people knew, some people didn't. What was interesting was that afternoon I spoke to the youth group. The young people knew. They knew more than the grown-ups. Okay. So to read, you know, when you do chanting, especially if you're chanting in Pali, you should know what you're saying. Otherwise, it's, you know, you know, because you don't understand it. Yeah. But we should know, you know, what are we saying? What are the qualities of the Buddha? Why do we, you know, go to the Buddha for refuge? When you know that, then, wow, you know, your faith really increases. It's not blind faith. Okay, another quality, first, 21st century Buddhists, we need to be socially involved, socially engaged. Okay? So, you know, sure, some people may just want to do long retreat like that, but as a Buddhist community in general, we should try and do things that directly benefit people in society. We should be known as a friendly community, so that when people come to the center, yeah, when you see new faces here, You go up to the people. You say, hi, how are you? Welcome to BF. Yeah? Do you know what we're about? You know, we're doing puja. Here's what puja means. Here's the book. You know, here's how we do it. Here's the translation. You know, so that you're friendly. You greet people. You welcome them in. Yeah, when they come to the center. And then to be socially active. And last weekend, I spoke at the Shenyu Counseling Center. They had representatives from a few different Buddhist groups. So some people were doing work with the elderly, going once a week into nursing homes and old folks' homes, reading to them, playing games with them, talking with them. You know, other people were doing prison work. There's so many different kinds of things that we can do to help society in a direct way. And I know Firefly is very involved with it in running projects overseas, you know, and setting up schools in different Buddhist countries so that children have a good education. All this kind of thing is really, really wonderful. Yeah? To be socially engaged. Yes, we have our time sitting on the cushion. Yeah. Yes, we meditate. But we also engage with real live people and do what we can to benefit them. Okay. It's another aspect of 21st century Buddhism. We don't stick our nose in the ground. Oh, the world has so much dukkha in it. The world has so much dukkha in it. I meditate on love and compassion, then I go and act out of love and compassion. Okay? Now, I know people have busy lives, so you have to see, you know, which kind of socially engaged work you want to do. Do you want to work with little children? Do you want to work with adults, you know, with the well, with the sick, with the incarcerated, you know? And you have to decide for yourself how much time you have. Yeah? Or maybe you want to offer service to the Dharma Center. That's another kind of socially engaged thing. Yeah? But to do something where we reach outside of ourselves and enact the Dharma in our lives. I think that's important. What else? Dialogue with science. Yeah? We should know something about science and be able to think, you know, of similarities and differences with a scientific perspective. You may know that His Holiness the Dalai Lama for many years now has been involved in dialogue with scientists. In fact, I think there's one going on in South India right now. Yeah? And there's a whole organization called Mind and Life Institute, yeah, that started out just as, you know, a few scientists dialoguing with His Holiness and a few Buddhists. But now, you know, they've gotten funding and there's a whole new field called contemplative science coming up, where scientists are studying the effects of meditation. They're studying the neurological changes in the brain when you meditate on compassion. They're setting up curriculums in school for how to teach children about compassion or how to teach them mindfulness. Yeah. So these kinds of endeavors, I think, is part of this thing of reaching out and contributing to society, but especially seeing the ways that Buddhism can link with science. Because so often it's seen like religion is over here and science is over there, and you can't mix them because they're going to quarrel. Okay? Because religion is just blind belief and science is based on fact. Actually, don't tell the scientists, there's a lot of science that's based on blind belief. may notice that the scientists come to different conclusions one year to the next. Have you ever noticed that? Yeah. I remember one year, eating eggs is very bad for you. Next year, eating eggs is good for you. Then avoid trans fat. Then avoid another kind of fat. You know? Then, eat butter. Don't eat butter. It has too much saturated fat. No, then eat butter. Don't eat margarine. You know? They keep changing their minds. Okay, that's okay. Human beings are inconsistent. We're always learning new things. Okay. But the scientific, my mental state is, we should be rigorous and we should examine and we should make sure things are true. And His Holiness has gone so far as to say that if scientists can actively disprove something the Buddha said, then we definitely should just release it and not believe it. But scientists not believing in something is different than scientists disproving it. Okay. So, for example, scientists, where they talk a lot, and they have a lot to say. If you Google the brain, you get so many pages of information about the brain. If you Google mind, scientists don't know what to say about the mind very much. They know a lot about the brain, but not a whole lot about the mind. Yeah. Buddhism has a lot of knowledge about the mind and how the mind works. Okay. And our knowledge is verified through personal meditative experience and also through using reasoning and logic. So in that way, we can come together and dialogue with scientists about philosophy, about the mind, about the relationship between the mind and the brain, about what is compassion, how do we cultivate it, And I think for society nowadays, it's very important that, religion and science can come together. This is one area where the Christians have a big problem, They have a real problem dialoguing with scientists. But the Buddhists don't. Yeah, because we're quite interested and we're more open-minded. So, for example, some of the Buddha's philosophy, the philosophy about selflessness, about emptiness, when they have dialogue with people who study quantum physics, they find a lot in common between Buddha's philosophy and what the physicists are coming up with. And I think, the more we can have this kind of dialogue and exchange, then the more people really see that Buddhism is a very intelligent religion. It's not blind belief. It's not old-fashioned. Yeah. It's very intelligent and very open-minded. Okay. There's some differences between Buddhists and scientists. Like I said, the scientists don't really know what mind means. And sometimes they really get into this materialistic reductionism. Like, it only exists if I can see it. Yeah. But that isn't a really productive viewpoint to look at life. Because we know that there's a lot that exists that we can't see. Because birds see things that we can't. You watch dogs and cats, they see things and hear things that we can't. So we can't, I don't think it's wise for science to just say we have to be able to prove it with scientific instruments, because there's a lot that is not the object that can, is not an object that can be known by scientific instruments. But there's different correlations, like I said, studying neurology, together with meditation. Yeah, studying philosophy and selflessness together with quantum physics. Okay? So I think that that's important, 20th century Buddhism. Yeah. Buddhists aren't burning paper money anymore. Yeah? When I first came to Singapore in 1987, so many of the young people came to me and they said, my family burns paper money. Is this Buddhism? And like I said, I didn't know anything about much about Chinese culture when I first came here. And I'm going, I don't think so. And then as I learned more about Chinese culture, I began to see, oh, burning paper money, that's ancestor worship. Okay, it's not Buddhism. Buddha did not teach burning paper money. And so there's a much, much better education in the Buddhist community now than there was 20-something years when I first came here. So I think that's quite good. People know that now. If you want to benefit your relatives when they die, try first to benefit them when they're alive. That's the best way to help them, is before they die. Yeah. Share Dharma materials with them. Yeah. Do things like that, where you can talk about the Dharma meaning in secular language and help your relatives in that way. Yeah, don't burn paper money, because it pollutes the environment. Yeah? And we Buddhists should definitely, you know, be educated about climate change. And we should definitely, oh, you're going to get me on my soapbox now. Okay, you know what it means when somebody gets on their soapbox? You know, because climate change is real, and we have a responsibility to future generations to cut down on green, you know, carbon emission, to cut down on garbage, and to learn how to recycle. And I must say, and I said this years ago, but you know, nobody listens to me. But I've been saying it for years. Sometimes Buddhist centers are the worst ones when it comes to recycling. Yeah. Because, you know, there's lunch, like after the Dharma talk and service on Sunday, there's lunch. What do we use? Styrofoam, plastic, paper plates, all these things. Styrofoam especially, horrible for the environment. So we eat with paper plates, plastic spoons, styrofoam cups, throw everything in the garbage. Yeah. We pollute the environment, not thinking that, you know, the future generations, your kids and grandkids, not my kids, okay? Your kids and your grandkids are gonna have to live in a polluted world. You know, so out of compassion, we should, you know, as Buddhists, reduce things and recycle. All these water bottles, yeah? Where's the recycling bin in the Dharma Center for all these water bottles? Do you know that, you know Suchi Foundation, yeah? They do marvelous social work. In Taiwan, they take the water bottles and they make blankets out of them. It's fantastic. Then when they go on the relief missions, you know, where there's natural disasters, they take with them the blankets made out of recycled water bottles. Yeah, Singapore certainly has a water bottles, don't you think? Yeah? We should do something similar. Okay? So cutting down on, you know, just frivolously using things and then discarding them. Yeah. not buying things that we really don't need. Now people are really going to get mad at me. Bad enough when I tell them that they need to recycle and not drive so much, or they need to ride public transportation. But now I'm going to tell you not to go shopping Sunday. Yeah. Why? Because we buy stuff we don't need. And all these things are natural, made of natural resources. And we use more than our fair share of natural resources. And we use something a few times, throw it away. Okay? We should really conserve things and use things until they wear out. Yeah, I'm an example of this. You can come and look at the hem. I don't know if you can see it on there. Yeah, the whole hem of my robe is completely ragged. Okay, I've had this robe since, when did I get this? I think 1998. Yeah. And my other robe I've had about since that time too. Yeah, if you look in the back of it, it needs some sewing. But I still wear it. Why do I need to throw it out and get a brand new one? It still works. Yeah? And nobody even notices. Yeah? Not one single Singaporean has commented to me on my hemline. Nobody notices. So? Good. Yeah? So, you know, to really use things until they wear out and, you know, not have, you know, closets stuffed full of things. You know, do you remember Imelda Marcos? Remember her? She's the one who, you know, I don't know, had hundreds of pairs of shoes.
Yeah. 2 to 3,000.
2 to 3,000 pairs, yeah, of shoes. 2 feet. And that many shoes. How many pairs of shoes do you have? How many shirts do you have? One body, but how many shirts? How many pants? How many dresses? Yeah? And do we just wear things a few times and throw them out? 21st century Buddhists were faced with environmental degradation. We need to stop consuming so much and to learn to recycle and to take care of the environment. Hmm? Now I better talk about something you like. Oh, here's another one. At least half of you are going to like this one. I don't know about the other half. 21st century Buddhism, gender equality. Yeah? Don't you think gender equality is important for the Dharma? You better all say yes. There's no choice on this group. Okay. Because Buddha's purpose is he wants all sentient beings to be enlightened. And he said women can attain full awakening. Okay. So the Buddha did not work just for the benefit of half the population. He worked for the benefit of all sentient beings. Yeah. So we should have gender equality. And in leadership positions, we should have women as well as men. And in Dharma teaching positions, we should have women as well as men. Yeah. Sometimes the women are a little bit shy. You've got to be braver. Yeah. Oh, I better not say anything. They may not like me. Cut that out. You're intelligent. You have something to offer. Offer it. You know what my teacher said to me? I was quite a new Dharma student at the time. And he asked me, to help lead a meditation course. And I said to him, you know, Lama, I can't, I don't know anything. And he looked at me and he said, you're selfish. Okay, Lama, what do you want me to do? You know? So, you know, sometimes we have to be active. Now, in my case, you know, like I said before, if I don't know anything, I don't make up answers. I just say flat out, I don't know, I'll go find out. But when we have talents and abilities, we need to use them and not be shy about them. And the men need to make sure that there's women on your, you know, your committees, that you have women teachers here. Yeah, that you support nuns. At the Abbey, we have gender equality, except the men can carry all the heavy things. Yeah, but aside from that, gender equality. And I think if Dharma is going to spread in the 21st century, we have to have gender equality. Modern people will not accept it in the old traditional way. Yeah, they will not accept it. And so we have to be with the times. What do you think? All the guys are good. I'm joking. Okay, but I think that that's something quite important. Yeah, quite important. Okay, another thing for, you know, in this thing with study is 21st century Buddhism. The lay people are getting a much better Buddhist education than before. Yeah, and I think that's important. Lay people need a good Dharma education. Just making merit isn't sufficient. In olden times, the lay people wanted to just make merit. They didn't learn so much. Now, all of us have to create merit, but all of us have to learn too. So don't think that just, you know, offering some things is sufficient for a Buddhist practice. Learn how to offer. Because what our motivation is when we offer determines how much merit we create when we make offerings. And offerings aren't the only way to create merit. And there's many ways to make offerings. There's offering service. There's offering time and energy. Okay. There's offering counseling. There's offering a compassionate heart and support when people, you know, are emotionally upset. There's many different ways to offer. Okay. And so, yeah, for lay practice, it should be more than simply, you know, creating merit. You shouldn't have a mind of kind of, this is what I call doing business with the Buddha. Yeah. Okay. Buddha, I really want my business to go well. I pray to you, may my business go well. And if it goes well, then I'll make a big donation to the temple. These people are very clever business people. They want the Buddha to make their business go well before they pay up. They don't make their donation first and then prayer. They say, Buddha, you make my business go well, then I'll make the donation. My business goes well. Sorry, Buddha, no donation. We shouldn't think like this. Yeah, we're not doing business with the Buddha. Yeah, we're not doing business with the Buddha. Yeah, we're trying to learn the Dharma and put it into practice and do it for the benefit of all beings. Okay. So we're not jostling Buddhists anymore. 21st century Buddhism, you can't be just stick Buddhist. Why do people wave the incense? Does anybody know? I've always wondered that. Yeah, everybody goes, lights it, and then goes like this. And does anybody know? I don't know. Why do people go like this? We should know. If we go like this, we should know why we go like that. Yeah.
Maybe it's the old ladies who first lady got Parkinson's disease.
So, you know, when we do something, if we don't know why we do it, ask. Ask. There's nothing wrong with asking. We should ask. In fact, one of the causes to be wise in our future lives is to ask questions to the wise in this life. Okay? What else? Yeah, along that line, there's also the whole topic of how do you create a relationship with a spiritual teacher? Yeah, what in the world does that mean? Because nowadays some people think, oh, I don't need a spiritual teacher. Yeah, I'll invent my own path. I'll take a little bit from this, a little bit from that, stir it up, make soup. Practice whatever my ego likes. Yeah. That's not wise. Okay, we have to learn properly. And I think it's very helpful to have a good relationship with a spiritual mentor. I know it's very helpful for my practice because I don't know anything. So I need to depend on people who know more than I do, who can guide me. But choosing spiritual teachers is a sensitive and delicate thing. Yeah. And we have to check teachers out. You don't marry the first person, you know, you don't marry somebody who you don't know, do you? Yeah. Because that's asking for trouble. Yeah. Oh, you look good? And that's sufficient criteria? I'll marry you? Out. Okay. So similarly, choosing our spiritual teachers, you know, we need to get to know a teacher. We need to listen to their teachers, see if what they teach corresponds with the general Buddhist presentation. We need to see if the teacher has good ethical conduct, if they're a kind and compassionate person, or are they, you know, trying to get a big following and a lot of offerings. We need to really check things out. And charisma is not, if you look in the sutras, the Buddha talks in the sutras and the commentaries about the qualities to look for in a good spiritual mentor. So we should know what those qualities are. And look for them, you know, in different people. Charisma is not one of them. But we, nowadays, people can be very gullible, you know. We like things that look good. Somebody, you know, looks like they're a holy being. Or they talk, you know. You know what I find sometimes? When I go to Malaysia to teach, they tell me I'm one of the few Tibetans there that actually teach, that most of the lamas come and do pujas. And I think that's true. But I think there's two things going on. The lamas do pujas, but the people ask for the pujas. And I've noticed with many people, they don't want to learn the Dharma. They want to offer and have somebody come and, you know, you ring your bell and you beat your drum and, you know, you wear some brocade and some big hat and then you go, oh, the less they understand, the more they think they're getting a big blessing. Yeah? The less they understand, and the more blessed water and cords. Let's see, how many cords do you get? Wow, look at this. This cord, you know who gave me this cord? It's going to protect me. It's called a protection cord. But you know what? I need to protect the cord because otherwise it breaks and it falls off. And then I'm going to, you know, I have some less pills that you can have afterwards. I'm not joking with that. It sounds good until your teacher doesn't. Why am I talking to me like this? I'm your best disciple. Don't you appreciate me? So we should learn how to be good disciples, how to be good students. Yeah? Okay, so I've been talking a lot about 21st century Buddhism. You probably have some questions or things that you want to say about it too. Yeah?
So, regarding gender equality, so when I received teachings on like karma, one of the things that came up was, you know, the results of good karma is you're born a man. And then, you know, I questioned.
So, and then I questioned that. And what I was told is, even in today's context, women are disadvantaged because of the physiology and because, you know, all the things that happens to us because we can't go and retrieve ourselves. So, and then there's also teaching on like to the last life that you have, you need to be born a man to become a Buddha. So I'm just requesting your explanation, like in this 21st century, these kind of teachings, how do we see them, and how would Dharma teachers, you know, put them in a different way?
Okay, so I see those teachings as coming out of a culture at a certain time in history, you know, a culture where in ancient India, a woman was like under the control of her father, then her husband, then her son. Yeah. Is that the case now? No. Yeah. Women function independently. They have jobs, they have careers. Yeah. So I see that as coming out of a very old cultural. And also with a lot of misconceptions, you know, when they say, oh, because you have a woman's body, you're so emotional. That is... incorrect. I've seen men be just as emotional, if not more emotional, than women. What do you think, guys? You have emotions, don't you? Don't you? You get upset. You're fickle. You go up and down like most emotional yo-yos. We're all in samsara together. Yeah. So this thing of women are more emotional, I don't believe that. You know? And by watching at the Abbey, oh, another one of the Buddhist misconceptions, you know, from the, when you look in the Vinaya and the scriptures, they see women as like just wanting to jump in bed with every man they see. Huh? Huh? You know, my experience growing up is the women were more reserved and the men were the ones who wanted to jump in bed with every woman they saw. Yeah? I see some of the guys nodding. Yeah. So, you know, I don't see these things as objective truths, but I see them as coming out of a culture at a certain time. Yeah. And really the fact of the matter is Dharma will not spread if we hold on to those kinds of things. And perpetuate them. Yeah.
If there's any question, you may raise your hand and I'll come to you with the mic so that, yeah.
Me, Dharma Chandra. I have one question. As we progress and we learn, like for example, I started learning a different tradition before I learned Tibetan Buddhism. So, the other tradition mentioned, before I actually learned, the other tradition say that Tibetan tradition, when you do meditation, you imagine too much. Mm-hmm. Always imagine, and you go haywire. And now I know it is, and I learned it, I start to see what I know. But I still continue to study the other tradition. But sometimes when they brought up this again, I feel like explaining it to the person, but I feel that they are not ready.
Yeah.
And if I explain too much, I'm afraid they will get negative, and then maybe create some negative karma, maybe they'll say something. So I kind of draw myself back. So I don't know the approach, you know, to explain it in a way that the person can accept it better and see it in a different light. Could you advise that? You know,
okay.
How to approach a situation like that?
Yeah. So are you talking about a Buddhist teacher, or are you talking about regular fellow practitioners?
Both we encounter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you really have to check out a situation and check out somebody's, you know, degree of open-mindedness. You know, one way is to just ask that person and say, you know, I've received some instruction in Tibetan Buddhism. I've done some visualization practices. Are you interested in knowing what it's like from the perspective of that tradition? And asking the person if they're interested in knowing. And they can say yes, they can say no. This is a very common misunderstanding. And, you know, from the viewpoint of one tradition that is teaching you Vipassana and Shamatha in one way, then they don't want you doing, imagining things. From the perspective of how you're trained in Tibetan Buddhism, we take that tendency to imagine and we put it in the use of the Dharma. Yeah, so it's not just distraction. But if somebody's been schooled in another meditation technique and they've never learned the philosophy behind the visualization, then they don't understand it. They see it as a distraction. But you can ask that person, you know, would you like me to share my experience? And then.
Thank you. Guru, I also think that, could you share with us how you conserve water at the abbey, because I find it very amazing what you did there when I went, and I find it so useful. I think what you sharing it with the rest could be also interesting for the Singaporeans.
Okay. Okay. Well, some of the Singaporeans aren't going to like it. I know that. But first of all, we have signs in all the bathrooms, please take short showers. Okay? So you don't stand under the shower for, you know, minute after minute and let the water, you know. Also, when we brush our teeth, we try and, you know, wet your toothbrush, do everything. Turn the water off, then brush our teeth, then turn the water back on to rinse out the toothpaste, instead of let the water run the whole time. Yeah. When you wash dishes, you know, have one pan with your soap and wash the dishes there, move it to another pan to wash it, instead of leaving the faucet running while you wash one dish, then you're talking to somebody while the faucet's still running, then you wash another dish, gallon after gallon of water goes by and you've washed five dishes. You know, that's a huge waste of water. Okay. And also, we flush the toilets when necessary, not after every time. Yeah. They have an English thing. What is it? I'll see if I can say. Yeah, people are like, they don't like this, but she asked the question. Asked the question. So there's an English thing. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. So it's a very good way to conserve water. You know, we conserve a lot of water. I like in Singapore that you have the toilets with the double flush, you know, one where you just have a little bit of water and one where you have water. That's very good. It saves a lot of water. Yeah. Then when you do laundry, do big loads of laundry instead of just one or two things. lots of ways to save water. And here's a Singaporean who went and survived.
So, one more question here.
Well, but I find that I'm a 21st century Buddhist. I have a degree in physics, and I'm working in a temple doing environmental protection now. Also doing recycling and encouraging people not to burn just paper. And also I'm all for gender equality, and I'm also taking a part-time degree in Buddhism to get to know more.
Good, very good.
And but we have time for maybe one more question.
One more question.
Yeah,
and that's going to have to
decide.
Start.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because tomorrow we have a retreat that starts at 10 o'clock. You're all coming, right? It's the most important thing you have to do is to practice the Dharma. I'll see you all tomorrow at 10. Yes.
Thank you, Madam. Do you feel that there's an increased radicalization of Buddhists?
Increased
radicalization?
Radicalization of Buddhists?
Example being the persecution of Muslims in Myanmar and even Sri Lanka.
Uh-huh. So the way the Buddhists are treating the Rohingya in Myanmar, it's abominable. Yeah? And as a Buddhist community, we should speak out against that and say, you know, Buddhism is not for that kind of discrimination and persecution. Yeah, we really should speak out enough, you know, more, and let the world know, and let the Burmese Buddhists know that, you know, what they're doing is not according to the Buddhist teachings. Answer your question, okay?
All right. So can we say sadhu three times and thank Venerable for the teachings today? Sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu.
Venerable, would you like to lead us in transference of merits?
Sure. Okay. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. And just spend a minute or two thinking about what you heard, so that you can remember it and take it home, so that it can influence your life. And let's rejoice what we did here together this evening, at all the goodness that we created, the merit, the compassion, the wisdom that we created together as individuals and also as a group. Let's rejoice. Then you can think of that merit as like a light in the center of your chest, and it radiates out into the universe, touching all the living beings. So as we share our merit, the result of our merit with all living beings, this light touches them, and think that it heals their body and mind, pacifies their afflictions, brings joy and clarity into their minds, so that everybody can practice well and gain realizations. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha.